What we're going to look at today is basically what is a budget, what are the theories of taxation, and what do we spend it on? And it's real easy to jump in as a politician and say, well, if I'm elected, I'll cut taxes by X percent or this, that, or the other. But I'll make sure we keep the same level of services that we have. Anybody that tells you that either thinks you're a fool or is a liar. And a combination of the two is not impossible. What is the function of a budget? It's a planning document. It lets you have to really think through what you're going to do in order to write a budget. Along about February or March of next year, I will be asked by the Vice President for Finances around here to put together the budget for my particular area. And in order to do that, I have to know what programs we're going to have. I have to have a pretty good idea of what, how many people I'm going to have. And I've got to establish some standards for how things are going to be done. If I've got a program that's costing X and it only brings in about a third X money, then the question's got to be, can we keep it? Or can we justify keeping it even though it doesn't produce the amount of money necessary? Some areas are going to produce more money than they have to have. Some areas are going to produce less. That's the way it goes. Now, in Texas, the budget process is relatively involved, but works fairly well most of the time. We talked about the Legislative Budget Board and the Legislative Audit Committee when we looked at the legislature, right? Does that ring a bell? I told you this is where we would look at them in a little more detail. The Governor's Budget Office, the Comptroller's Office will play it in, and then all the agencies that actually spend the money. So what are the steps in the budget process? Like I said, right now I'm in the process of bethinking about the planning, and then right after Christmas I'll start really planning. Now, what complicates the budget process in Texas is that you have a two-year budget. We are the only major urban state in the union that has a two-year budget. Por qué? Why? You know the answer to this. We're the only state in the union that uses, only state, major state, that uses what? Biennial legislative sessions, right?
Yeah.
If the legislature only meets every other year, then it's got to write a budget for a two-year period. The budget authorizes the expenditure of the money. And then the executive is responsible for the actual spending of the money. And we'll look at the auditing process. Auditing is integral to the part of having a system that functions well. The legislature is heavily invested in all of these steps except the spending part in Texas. So, to talk about the planning considerations. We're the only major urban state with a biennial budget. Now, most states have in their constitutions a requirement for balanced budgets. But sometimes they allow some real interesting budgetary tools to help theoretically balance the budget. Texas has not in the past, but right now I can show you one area where we're fudging. Funds can be dedicated. That is to say, they can only be set aside for certain purposes. If when the gasoline tax, for example, is collected, it has to be used for certain purposes. The proposal, Constitutional Amendment Number 7, is designed to help reallocate some of the money that comes in to the Texas Highway Department. And if you haven't read it, I've sent you, I gave you a copy of it. Take a look at it. And then there's all sorts of constitutional and statutory restrictions about how the money can be used. Now, I do not expect you to memorize this, all right? Everybody in agreement? But we have, for example, in Article 3, Section 49A, a pay-as-you-go provision which sets up the requirement, sets up the way the Texas balanced budget system is going to work. Now, Article 3, Section 51, was adopted about 20-plus years ago that set absolute limits on how much welfare spending we can have. Now, if you look at the budget, which we will in a minute, you'll see that we spend a whole lot more on health and human services than 1% of the overall general revenue. So how do we get around the fact that we have a cap on welfare, but at the same time we're spending more money on human resource? Well, we can call it anything so long as you don't call it welfare. You can get around the cap. We unfortunately do a fair chunk of this, I call it constitutional lying. Now, one of the things I have really railed against in my 50 years of teaching is coming up with these provisions that may not prove to be particularly useful. Article 8, Section 22 of the Texas Constitution is a good example of that. It says, regardless of how much money the legislature is bringing in, regardless how much the taxes are producing, the amount of money you spend cannot exceed the rate of growth of the state's economy. Now, can any of you reasonably predict 30 months in advance what the rate of growth for the economy is going to be? But you've got to.
How?
Well, when you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Okay, I apologize for that. I know I cracked it. So the comptroller regularly comes in, looks and figures out how much money we're really going to have to spend, and then, poof, magically, their rate of growth. If you look at how often the rate of growth projection matches the actual rate of growth, it's almost as bad as the weather forecast. Oh, it's going to rain about 1 to 2 inches. What we got 7.5 inches in Tiki Island.
Wow.
They got almost 12 inches in LaPorte. You know that LaPorte schools are closed today. Flooded. They didn't build them down low either. It flooded a number of them. And then on top of that, they threw in a tornado or two.
Yeah. Lake Jackson, Pasadena,
Yeah,
area, and all that.
Well, and then Article 8, Section 1 limits the types of taxes that Texas can levy. How many of you are familiar with stools, either three or four-legged stools? Okay. How stable do you think the stool would be if you cut off three of the legs?
Not good.
We have one amendment that cut off the income tax. Another amendment that cut off the state property tax. Now, how many different large broad-based taxes can states rely on?
One. Oh,
three.
Three. So they already cut
sales taxes, property taxes, and income taxes.
So they already cut two.
And two of the three legs we've cut off. Which is why Texas has some of the highest consumption taxes of any state in the union. We have the fourth most regressive tax system of any state in the union because sales taxes are by nature relatively regressive. They hit low and middle income people more heavily than they do people at the upper end of the income spectrum. So who plans this thing? Well, we got the Legislative Budget Board, Legislative Audit Committee, the Governor's Office, the Comptroller's Office, and then the state agencies. I think we said that. I tell you, we talk about the LBB. Here it is. Lieutenant Governor and the Speaker. Now, do I want you to memorize which members are automatically on there? Nah, you can look it up. Would you want the chairman of the House committee that's responsible for writing the budget on there? Yeah. How about the chairman of the House committee that determines what the level of taxes are going to be? What kind of taxes? Yeah. They don't have but one committee in the Senate called the Finance Committee. Okay? Don't have two. So those three are automatically on there, plus two House members appointed by the Speaker and three senators appointed by the Lieutenant Governor. So, true or false, the leadership of the Senate plays an extremely significant role in determining how the budget of Texas will be created and the tax structure of the state?
True.
That's a big true with a B. That's a capital T, and that rhymes with what? Never mind. Somebody asked me the question, does it matter who the lieutenant governor is? And my answer is, well, actually, my real answer is, yes, it is. And what I want to say is, yes, it is. All right, where are the steps? These are the steps that any governmental agency has to go through. It's just the names have been changed to protect the innocent or the guilty. When will the state agencies start thinking about their budget? Interestingly enough, they already have. Starting about September of the odd numbered year. Now wait a minute. When was the budget for this 2-year period concluded or signed into law? In early June of this year. So they're already into the planning process. Now, Texas does something a little interesting, and no other state that I have been able to determine does it this way. The Legislative Budget Board staff and the governor's budget staff work together. I've looked at every other major state in the union, and they don't do this. Part of it, of course, is the Legislative Budget Board is the biggest dog on the block. The governor's budget office has 2 or 3 people at most working with it, and there's about 50 to 60 people working in the Legislative Budget Board. So guess who they have to depend on for staffing? LBB. And there's been a great deal of cooperation between the LBB and the governor's budget office. Now, along about January of 2016, it's going to start getting serious. The LBB and the LEBO will start reviewing with the staff of the agencies their proposed budgets. Now, you obviously couldn't do every agency's budget in a 6-week period, could you? So where do you start with which ones would you start with? The really big, hard ones? Are the easy ones that's not going to change from year to year?
The hard ones?
You got 100 and some odd licensing agencies that are primarily funded by license fees. That's not going to change massively. The staffing is not going to change massively.
No, you just start with
we'll knock ones. Those out in a hurry. We can't predict how many students are going to be in college 2 years in advance. We can't predict how many public school students. Blah, 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 blah. So we're going to save those biggies for a little later on when the data is a little harder, a little more firm. Does it make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Now, all along in here, the comptroller's making an estimate of how much money is going to be available. And if he or she says, there's only going to be about X million dollars available in this fund, does it make any sense to try to appropriate X million plus 50 million? No. Because as we're going to see at the end of the process, the comptroller has the final say of whether or not the budget is going to fly. Got it? So, somewhere along about September to January of the odd-numbered year, the LBB and EBO staffs will conclude their recommendations, and it'll be ready for presentation to the legislature in January of the odd-numbered year, because the legislature meets in January of the odd-numbered year, right? And did I tell you last time around, I know I did, this is a rhetorical question, that beginning with Ann Richards in 1991, the governor quit trying to submit a full budget to the legislature, and now for the last, how long is that? 15 years, governors just produced a document which demonstrates where they are in disagreement with what the LBB is presenting. Now, here's what the LBB is trying to present. In most instances, it's a status quo budget. Are you familiar with that word, status quo? What does it mean? Current situation. If you fund the program at its current level, here's what it's going to cost. Now, why don't we just take last year's budget and duplicate it and stick it in? Well, because the factors that drive the budget may be different. For public schools, the number of students, this. In colleges, the number of students, the cost of students, blah, blah, blah. Roads, number of roads that need to be repaired, blah, 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 blah. So last year's figure won't necessarily be, or last 2 years' figure won't necessarily be accurate. But if you're going to maintain the same level of services, here's what it's going to cost. Now, if the governor's proposing to cut the level of services or to increase the level of services, they got to put a price tag on it. And that's where the governor's budget generally differs from the LBB budget in terms of policy differences, what we want to emphasize. Everybody cool on that? Then it goes to the legislature. And then the budget process in the legislature begins. In the House, there's two committees, the Ways and Means. They used to call it the House Taxation Committee, but then I guess they all got scared of the word taxation and decided to use the word Ways and Means because Congress did it, and Appropriations, and the Senate Finance Committee. And then something that's a little bit, I haven't found another Senate in any other state, major state, that does this. The Senate Committee of the Whole on Finance. That's where all 31 senators receive a briefing on the budget. And each of the chairs of the important committees like transportation, education, so forth, present the information to the legislature on the LBB recommendation and LBB proposal. Now, Caroline, who do you think really prepares that information for the chair of the committee? Do you think that the chair sits in there and creates this all on his own? Or does it look like the LBB staff have canned this thing for him? Remember I showed you the Texas fiscal size up? Okay. Everything the LBB presents is available on their website. And if you've got lots of time and lots of bandwidth, download it and take a look at it. It's detailed. So here's the process. The committees start hearing. Now the House and the Senate
do things differently.
Come on.
Do things differently.
If you had the time, well, if you were willing to listen to me for that length of period of time, I could explain to you in great and painful detail how the House and the Senate differ in terms of the way they handle appropriations. Are you comfortable with me just telling you they do it
differently?
One little chunk of information about how they do it differently. In the House, they break the bill up and send it to each of the standing committees that has responsibility, like the Public Education Committee gets the part of the bill, finance bill that deals with public education. The Higher Education Committee gets the part of the bill that deals with higher education. The Transportation Committee gets the part that deals with highways. Health and Human Services gets the part that deals with Health and Human Services. And each of them are told, here is the amount of money you've got to spend. Look at the LBB proposals, rework them, and decide how you want it to work. But don't come in with X plus umpteen jillion extra dollars because we ain't got them. In the Senate, it all just goes to the Senate Finance Committee, and the Senate Finance Committee deals with it. But 25 of the 31 members of the legislature of the Senate are on the Senate Finance Committee. So it's dang near like everybody. If you don't get put on the Senate Finance Committee, it's a pretty good idea that either A, you didn't want to be on it because it's a lot of work, or B, the lieutenant governor really doesn't like you. All right, so each of the committees hold hearings. They make their recommendations. Each chamber eventually votes on it. If the House and the Senate bills are different, and they always will be, it goes to a conference committee, and that's where the final version of the bill gets written. Now, once it has passed both the House and the Senate, the conference committee report has been approved. Next stop, comptroller's office. Remember I told you the comptroller has ultimate say? Hey, there is where he and his bean counters get together and they decide whether they can certify it. What happens if he doesn't? He or she doesn't? Does it go into the governor anyway? Well, not unless 4/5 of both houses override the comptroller. How often has that occurred? Anybody like to guess? Zip. 4/5, I don't think you could get most of them to agree that 4/5, that December the 25th was Christmas. All right, then it goes to the governor. The governor of Texas has an item veto. That means he can cut any single item out of an appropriations bill. Since the legislature generally sends him the bill in the last 10 days of the session, and he has 20 days to deal with it, and they can't call themselves back into special session, if the governor item vetoes something, it's generally dead. Now, I might step on a toe or two here, but c'est la vie, monsieur pussycat. There's two groups of people by the end of Rick Perry's 12 years in office disliked Rick Perry. One group was called the Democrats, the other group was called the Republicans. I don't know how to say this without being tacky. Here's the problem with Rick. Normally, governors, did we discuss this when I was talking about vetoes? Well, okay, I don't have to do it again. Governors worked with members to tell them they were unhappy with something and that they wanted to see it changed or wanted something done before we got to the veto stage. Perry didn't do that. He just went, surprise! When you've invested a whole lot of time, energy, and effort, and the governor's office has never said boo about why they're unhappy with something, and then they suddenly slash it. Well, let me tell you an adage my grandmother had. Your friends may desert you, your enemies never will. Be careful who you make enemies. And I don't think there was more than about, a fifth of the legislature that Perry hadn't shafted in one way or another. They might be all smiles and sweetness and light in public, but when it came to being back behind the scenes, it could get ugly. So there wasn't too many of them that were unhappy to see him leave. Now, Abbott, I think, learned his lesson. If you paid any attention, he did not item veto very many items in this session. Very, very few. He did discuss, at least his staff did discuss with members when there were problems. Now, spending agencies have the responsibility to spend. The comptroller's office oversees how that spending goes. And then, in the event money has to be moved around, the governor's has to ask the LBB for approval to move the money around. As far as I know, Texas is the only state where the legislative budgeting agency has to give its approval before the governor can move money from one account to another. That's called budget oversight or budget execution authority. So the governor is extremely limited in budget execution authority. Everybody got that? Does anybody remember? It's kind of theoretically a children's fable of Gulliver's Travels, where the Gulliver's tied down by the Lilliputians with thousands of little strings. No, your head didn't go to that one. All right. Well, that's kind of the way the governor is in terms of the budget. There's a thousand different little strings that sort of tie him down. Now, auditing is a process. All right. Who is on the Legislative Audit Committee? Now, she's not being rude. She's got to go. I mean, not that kind of go, but... Does any of that look familiar? Lieutenant Governor, the Speaker, the Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, the Chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. Where have we seen that? They're on the LBB, aren't they? So the committee that's responsible for auditing or hiring the auditor is the same people who write the budget. We are the only state that does that. I can tell you up front, we are the only state where the auditor is hired by the people who write the budget. Now, normally audit reports, can pick on you, Ms. King? Normally what happens to audit reports? Unless they find grave and grievous errors, they go up on the shelf and people maybe look at them and mostly don't. If you want to get the head of an executive department in Texas to order a case of Depends, just give him a negative audit rating. Do I need to explain that? What happens if the Legislative Audit Committee finds serious deficiencies in the way an agency handles its money? Well, the first thing they do is they fire the people in the agency that was responsible for doing it. And then they get serious. So, do you think a little note from the Legislative Audit Committee or the state auditor that there's something here that appears to be questionable is going to get attention? Oh, yeah. No question about it. All right. State auditor is picked by the Legislative Audit Committee. Now, I'm going to go kind of fast on this. When I worked in the legislature back in the 1960s, the only kind of audits they did were financial or compliance audits. Were they doing it legally? And then they decided, well, you might be doing it legally, but you're not doing it economically. You're not doing it in an efficient way. So we added to it efficiency economy audits. And then about 30 years ago, we added effectiveness audits. You might be doing it legally, you might be doing blah, blah, but you're not doing anything. You're not accomplishing anything. So effectiveness audits. Then they check to make sure that your personnel classifications are honest, that you're really hiring people at the level that they're supposed to be at, and they're doing the jobs they're supposed to be doing. And whenever, if legislative committees need support, then they throw that in as well. Texas has one of the better audit systems in the states, to be very honest about it. All right, taxation. There's two basic theories. We're changing gears, if you hadn't noticed. Two basic theories of taxation. Those who receive the benefit pay for it, and those who have the money pay for it. Incidents. I mean, exactly, you can't ask the prisoners in the prison system to pay for their incarceration, right? Who benefits? And of course, always the question is, how do you determine who really benefits from something? Who benefits from roads? Let's say that I live in the inner city, I take public transportation, do I benefit from highways? Well, how does the food that I eat get delivered? Then we look at incidents. Which sectors of the economy pay for it? Progressivity. Progressivity, regressivity are a concept that is fairly easy to understand, but you got to understand it. A progressive tax taxes at a higher rate those who make more. And a regressive tax taxes at a higher rate those who make less. I think I mentioned to you that when you look at all the types of taxes we have in Texas, Texas is the fourth most regressive state. I could post that article for you if you want to read it. Fourth most regressive state in the union in terms of its taxes, primarily because we depend so heavily on sales taxes. When you're trying to look at the criteria for a tax, you look at efficiency. Does it deliver all the money it's supposed to? How much does it cost to collect it? How convenient is it? Does it provide the amount of money that we need? Is it fair? And are there ways to escape it? We could get tied up on this for a long time, and I'm not going to do it. Now, there's a lot of politicians out there who would like to tell you that Texas is a, you know, taxes are terrible. But the truth of the matter is, of the major states in the union, only Florida and Georgia have a lower incidence per capita tax revenue burden than does Texas. New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, California, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Washington, Michigan, North Carolina, Ohio, Virginia, Arizona, and then Texas. On spending, we're a very low spending state as well. Now, every election, somebody will talk about how much more money we're spending at the state level. Well, has the population leveled off in Texas? No. Is inflation a factor? Not as much as it was, but if you have a $1 billion budget, figure out what 3% of it is. If you've got a 3% inflation rate, figure out what 3% of $1 billion is. New services, as we have urbanized and industrialized, Texas ends up having to spend more money for new state services. And then, of course, there are federal mandates, rules by the federal government. I can give you one example, the ADA, the Disabilities Act. That ended up costing the state of Texas money. All right, what I want to do next, real quickly, is talk about where the money goes. If we rank Texas with other states, our overall spending per capita is 50th. That means we are the lowest per capita of any state in the union. State wages, parks and recreation, cash welfare. There's one area, however, where we do break into the top quartile. Corrections. Is there a correlation between our spending on education and mental health and the percentage of people that we tuck away in prisons? In fact, most of the studies show there is a very definite relationship. Somewhere between 30% and 50%, depending who does the studies, of all the people we have in prisons in Texas are mentally ill. And part of the biggest reason they end up being in prison is because we haven't done anything about their mental illness. We spend our per capita spending on mental health puts us at 47th in the country. Now, why that is important is it costs a heck of a lot more to incarcerate people than it does to treat them. And there's some discussion about, you know, getting smart on this. Does it make sense to spend $50,000 a year incarcerating somebody when we could spend $20,000 a year treating them for mental illness and perhaps keeping them under control? This is a fairly interesting chart. Notice where it comes from. It comes from the Comptroller of Public Accounts. It looks at what we have been spending money on tax revenue versus non-tax revenue, that is to say, income that we get from not from taxes. So what I want to show you And I'm not expecting you to memorize big chunks of this. I just want you to take one chunk of information away with you. Taxes make up only slightly over half of the total revenue the state of Texas spends. The second largest chunk of money the state of Texas spends are federal funds. And back when Rick Perry was talking about, well, we could secede from the union, and I had a number of people here in Galveston going, yeah, we'll just secede. I said, all right, you ready for your taxes to double in Texas? What do you mean? If you didn't have federal funds, we'd have to raise that money somewhere, which means we probably increase the sales tax to 15-16%. Oh no! So, I mean, just face the reality. One third basically of the Texas budget comes from the federal government. And we're going to see that it does not get spent evenly across the board. Fines and fees, another 7%, interest 4%. The lottery is only about 2% and declining as people figured out that your chances of being struck by lightning are greater than your chances of winning the lottery. Statistically, that's true. Now, if you stand out in a thunderstorm with a steel umbrella, you might could improve your odds. So, what is the biggest chunk of taxes in Texas? Well, the sales tax brings in 52%, but is the motor fuel tax really and truly a sales tax? Yeah. Is the motor vehicle tax really and truly a sales tax? So let's add those up. 7 and 4 is 11, 8 and 5, 8 and 7 is 15, so that's 16.4%. 16% added to 52%. What do you get?
16 added to 52, you get 7.
Close enough to saying two-thirds?
Yeah.
Two-thirds of state revenue come from sales or consumption taxes. We rely more heavily on consumption taxes than any other state in the union, and particularly more than any other urban state. Corporate franchise tax 14.4%, and then everything else 11%. Oil and gas taxes, and what has the comptroller just released a report on possible oil and gas? Now this is the state's share of oil and the revenue produced by oil and gas production on state lands. What do you think has happened to the production that this oil and gas revenue? It's dropped like a rock. Por qué? It's a percentage of the overall value of the minerals being produced. When oil was selling at $100 a barrel, we were getting X amount. When oil is at $50 a barrel, we get half of that. So it's going to put a pretty good chunk. If the price of oil does not markedly improve, the next session of the legislature is going to have to be figuring out how to make up the difference. When we look at sales taxes in the most populous states per capita, the good news is we are not number one in total per capita. Washington State, Florida, Michigan, Arizona barely beat us out. So what do we spend it on? What is the biggest single item in the state budget? Education. Absolutely. Next biggest chunk is health and human services. Next biggest chunk is highways. And then the rest of it's pocket change. If we did away with every state agency other than the education, health and human services, and transportation department in Texas, how much could you save? 6.2 plus 1.9 plus 0.04, 11%. Back a number of years ago, Bill Clements had campaigned on a platform that I will reduce state taxes by 20%. I'll reduce state spending by 20%. He sent his proposal to the legislature, and I'm going to tell you, you could hear the thud of that proposal dying before it ever hit the floor. Because the legislators who had prisons in their districts said, all right, which prisons do you want to close down, and how's that going to affect my community? How many communities in Texas have institutions of higher education in their district? Out of the 31 state senators, how many state senators do you think have at least one state college or university in their district? Last count, 24 to 25. Do you want to close down or severely reduce enrollment in my college? Forget it. Which grades do you want to cut out of public school?
None.
Which roads do you want to not maintain? It was one of those proposals fueled by rhetoric, not reason. And within about a month, he dropped that particular turkey. Now, when we say education, two-year schools like Galveston College get 3% of the overall education expenditures. Colleges and universities get 25%, and public schools get 67%. Do I want you to memorize that? No. No reason to. When we look at health expenditures, about almost 60% of all the money we spend on health and human services in Texas comes from the federal government. Remember I showed you that one-third of the overall state revenue comes from the federal government? Well, this is the function that receives the biggest chunk of that. So what are the allocation of federal funds? 60% of it goes for health and human services, 17% for education. Do I want you to memorize these figures? Heavens, no. I just would like for you to have a little bit of an understanding that health and human services, education, and transportation are the three biggies in terms of where the federal money goes. So if we had followed Rick Perry's musing, he was a political threat that was absolutely useless, of we'll succeed from the union. Who would take the biggest hit? Hospitals? Community. You think UTMB would have received any hit at all. If all of a sudden we didn't have federal funds to help support UTMB? Galveston and part of Galveston County would look like a desert zone. Oh, we just announced that we're laying off half the people at UTMB. What would that do to the economy? Education. If we suddenly completely eliminated Pell Grants, what would it do to Galveston College? What would it do to many of the students who attend Galveston College? Would not be pretty. I want to show you where you get this kind of information. All right. If any of you say, well, Mr. Waddell made up a whole bunch of stuff. No, Mr. Waddell did not make this up. Trust me, I do not have that ability. You can go to the Legislative Budget Board, and they have umpteen jillion nice, wonderful charts that can tell you more than you ever wanted to know about where the money comes from and where it goes. And it's available to you as a citizen as well as to the legislature. All right, we're about to wrap this up. I'm sure you'll be crushed. And my voice is holding up a lot better than I thought it would. Yesterday I was barking like a coon dog. True or false? Texas really doesn't have much public debt.
False.
It's not only false, it's false with a capital F. Let me tell you what we've done. There's two kinds of debt. There's secured debt and unsecured debt. That is to say, debt which has an identifiable source of income to pay it off, and debt which does not. Do I need to give you an example of that? Everybody comfortable with that? Let me give you one example. Secured debt. You buy a house to rent. You got a mortgage on it. What will be the source of the funds that you use to pay the mortgage note, the taxes, the insurance, etc.? The rent that you're getting on the house. And as long as you're getting more rent than you are debt, maintenance and so forth, you're ahead of the game. Very few people could go in and afford to buy a $1.5 million apartment complex with pocket change. But as long as they know that they can rent it out, they're fine. That's secured debt. Veterans land bonds, money that we've borrowed and we've loaned out to veterans to buy houses, to buy farms and so forth. That's pretty secured. Water development board borrows money, builds reservoirs, dams, loans it to local units of government to build reservoirs and water supply. What is the secure source of income for that? They're selling the water. Higher education. Anybody plan on attending UT or UTMB or Texas A&M? To build the buildings that they've needed, they've issued what are known as tuition revenue bonds. The students pay a building use fee. The student use fee over a period of 20, 30 years pays back the money that they borrowed to build the buildings. Got it? Secured debt. Mental health and mental retardation, well, we're kind of relying on. Let's skip the little ones there. Criminal justice. About 30 years ago, the state of Texas was faced with a tremendous dilemma. Most of its prisons were outdated, outmoded, and undersized, and we needed to build additional prisons. So we borrowed the money. But it's unsecured. There is no solid revenue stream to pay that back. Huh. Now, when you borrow money, you can borrow it on one of two bases. One is called an amortized basis, where the amount of money that you pay each year ultimately pays off the principal as well as the interest, or a balloon note, where the only thing you're paying is the interest. The downside to a balloon note is at the end of the period of the loan, you've got to come up with all the money for the principal, and you've been paying the interest all along. Guess which kind of notes we took out for the prison system? Balloon. Because there was no solid stream of money. The convicts weren't making the money. And so many of those buildings are pretty much reaching their useful life expectancy, and we're going to have to replace them. But we haven't paid off the buildings we built, besides having the money to build the new buildings we're going to need. How many of you remember the little Christmas presents they used to have? It's kind of like a little box. If you opened it, the Joker jumped out and jumped at you. How many of you remember those? You know, you give them to small kids and they say the joke. There's the Joker. Now, notice that I did not, that's general obligation. I did not talk about revenue bonds. And I've got to talk about the biggie, the one that really is behind Proposition 7 on the Constitution. Has Texas had to build and maintain a whole lot of initial roads over the last 10 years in order to meet population growth?
Yes.
Have we increased the gasoline tax? Have we gotten additional streams of revenue to pay for all of those additional roads and reconstruction? So, how have we done it? Is it magic? How about we do this? We have a solid stream of money coming in from the gasoline tax. It is not adequate to take care of the building of the new roads and maintaining the roads we've got. But what if we go and borrow the money to take care of the current needs and pledge the revenue stream to do it? Let me give you an example that you'll understand. You have X amount of income, but your style of living, your standard of living requires X plus. And you happen to have a credit card. So each month you put the difference between what you need to live on and what your income is on the credit card. But each month the minimum that you have to pay goes up, meaning you have less and less money in the overall total. I have just described to you the way we have financed Texas highways over the last 20 years. Does the example make sense to you? What's happening now is there's not enough money in the income stream to take care of the maintenance that we need. And so, but we still got to pay off all of these bonds. And guess what? They're balloon notes. We're only paying the interest on them. We're not paying off the principal. Not a good sign, Tonto. And I will admit, I'm kind of an old guy, and by the time all of this eventually comes due, I'll probably be dead or won't care. But I really worry about folks like you, the younger generation, who've been stuck, are going to be stuck with this, and it won't be pretty. You ask me, is this a liberal or a conservative issue? And the answer is no. It's just telling the truth. So what are the challenges going to be? The state of Texas is going to have additional revenues. Even if we do not increase the standard of what we're doing, population growth, the change in the demographics, and the fact that we've got all of this unsecured balloon note stuff means we're going to have additional revenue. If we had the time and you had the patience, I could discuss the fact that the state of Texas has been consistently underfunding public schools for over 30 years. All sorts of gimmicks. One was the Robin Hood plan, where we take from the rich districts and give to the poor districts. Now, how many of you in the back of your mind actually believe that Galveston is a rich school district? And yet it is classified as such. Even Lamarck, which is struggling mightily, is classified as a property-rich district. It was one of the biggest boondoggles the legislature ever pulled off in the 1990s. The Texas Supreme Court declared the method of financing Texas public schools to be unconstitutional, and it was. So they came up with the Robin Hood plan to take from the rich districts to pay to the poor districts, and the state can say, we didn't raise taxes. Well, they didn't at the state level, but they did at the local level. Higher education is going to continue to grow. If Texas is going to continue to grow, Texas higher education is going to have to continue to grow. Now, in health benefits, public employees, school teachers, did you know that we do not provide health insurance for public school teachers? That is solely the responsibility of the local districts. There is no state money and no state provision for it. We are educating the heck out of an awful lot of young people to become teachers, and a big percentage of them are moving to greener pastures, to other states. That's true of doctors too, by the way. And one of our big deficiencies in Texas is we on health education, we gets kids through medical school. They finish their third degree in medical school, but what goes beyond, what comes after you finally graduate with your degree, your medical degree, before you become licensed to be a doctor? You have to do a residency. And the state pays you a modest salary to be a resident. You're a doctor, partly a doctor in training, partly not, okay? The state of Texas does not fund its residency programs such that all of the third-year graduates can get residencies in Texas. Now, about 90% of the students who finish their residency in a state, stay in the state where they did their residency. Now, I don't know how many of you remember Scotty Edler, who taught here, taught part-time for us. Excellent history teacher. His wife, Melissa, is a medical school student. They ended up in Mobile, Alabama, because there were no medical school residencies. She's OBGYN. And we've got a critical shortage of OBGYN doctors in Texas. She's in her, will be, this is her first year, no, this is her second year as a medical resident. He would like to come back to Texas, but I'm not sure Melissa's that interested, ultimately. I'd love to have him back here. Right now, health insurance for the uninsured, Medicaid, and I'm not going to go into all the discussion on that, but the state of Texas has refused to accept federal Medicaid dollars, and that is putting a major burden on hospitals like UTMB, Baylor, etc. All right, what's causing it to grow? This is the last slide. Growth in population, inflation, need for new state services, federal mandates. Hey, I think we've been there, haven't we? That look familiar? Good. All right, if you came in late, I'm going to check.